about the range of students in any classroom today, you'd be right in thinking that there'll be children with a whole range of differences. Some will have physical disabilities, like spina bifida or cerebral palsy. Others might have sensory disabilities, say vision impairment. Then there'll be those with intellectual disabilities, maybe like Down syndrome, plus kids with learning disabilities, ADHD, dyslexia, also language disorders and autism spectrum disorder. Of course, it wasn't always the case. If you go back 50 years, education for children with special needs was very different. But whether the integrated system we have today is the best for everyone, that's still up for debate, I think. I would, of course, be interested to hear from you. Tell me, if you have a child with a disability, how have they been supported at school? Has it worked? You can text 0418 226 576 or contribute to the Life Matters Facebook page. Now, let me introduce you to a couple of people with expertise in special needs education. Dr. Shirley Pode, she's from the Melbourne Graduate School of Education, and Dr. Linda Graham, who's Associate Professor in the School of Early Childhood and Inclusive Education at Queensland University of Technology. Shirley, if you look back at how schools have supported children with disabilities over the years, there has been, you know, quite a change. Take us back to sort of 50 years ago and how it worked then.
It's quite a significant shift that's happened in the education of kids with disabilities. 50 years ago, it's most likely that children with disabilities attended a special school only, most likely one that had been set up to accommodate their specific needs. So if they were deaf, they went to a school for deaf children. And it's changed significantly since then.
So, Linda Graham, there are those still, I think, some special schools, particularly in certain states. Who are they for?
Well, there's a range of different special schools, and of course they run across different systems. So you have government and independent and Catholic special schools, but predominantly you have government schools. New South Wales has the largest number of special schools in the country, and at last count they had about 113. 64 of those were for what you would call traditional disability types. So, you know, children with physical disabilities like cerebral palsy, intellectual impairment, severe autism. Those children, you know, tend to go to those special schools. But then there's a range of new an increasing number of special schools for students with very disruptive, challenging behaviour. Other states haven't quite taken off in that yet, and I kind of hope they don't.
Ah, all right, we'll get on to that. But what I'm saying about, you know, there being a range of children with a range of disabilities and disorders in the sort of mainstream classroom much more now than as we're talking about going back to the 1970s is correct, yeah?
Yes, in that, you know, going back to prior to the 1970s, we were actually lucky if children with a severe disability were in schools at all. But over the last 20 years, we have taken a bit of a backward step. And I think schooling is becoming so difficult and so competitive that the support for students with additional needs is in a way forcing children out of regular classrooms. And that's a big problem that we need to address.
Shirley, going back to, the 1970s, some of the disorders that I mentioned probably wouldn't have had names or would have been regarded differently then, yeah?
That's true. So as we learn more about different children and their different needs, we understand more about the types of disabilities and we understand that they present differently in different kids. And over time, different names have emerged to label those types of needs that children might have. And what we've also seen is names that have come into favour and then gone out of favour again.
So say with, disorders that wouldn't have been recognised 50 years ago, ADHD and language disorders, I think. How common are they for kids in mainstream schools now?
They're far more prevalent, obviously, than what they were 50 years ago because the names weren't known then. Although there would have always been children in a classroom 50 years ago that had trouble with their attention, found it hard to maintain focus, might have daydreamed or fidgeted during class. One of the differences for those set of learners is that they didn't stay in school as long. They often finished school at the end of year 8 or the end of year 10 and went into jobs that were more suited to their levels of attention. Those kids now stay on school a lot longer, and as my colleague Linda has mentioned, schooling's become a lot more complex, and so those needs present more significantly, I think, in classrooms today.
So, Linda, if you're a child entering school today and you have, say you have signs of a learning disability or a mild intellectual disability, is it likely that you'll have already been diagnosed, or is it the school that often picks it up?
Well, that really depends on the child's background and the resources of the parents. It depends on the severity of, how the child is presenting and whether that disability or difficulty is present in a prior to school type setting, because often with children it's the demand, the increasing demand of the curriculum that really starts to put pressure on that child and makes, I guess, whatever difficulties they have more noticeable. But say, for example, if the child is attending a high quality prior to school setting with trained early childhood teachers, they will start to notice whether that child, for example, you mentioned language disorder or developmental language disorder, they will start to notice if the child is not speaking in the same way as other children, whether they are, if there are problems with the grammatical structure of, their conversation. So they will start to say to the parents, you might need to get this checked out. Then you have other children, and we've seen this in a longitudinal study that I'm running at the moment, where children are coming to school and it is very, very obvious that that they're not at the same stage as other children, and that can become or go on undetected by anybody.
Yes, well, Shirley, how good are schools at referring when they should, and specialists at diagnosing correctly?
In my experience, I think schools are reasonably quick to refer. They will typically notice if a child is not developing at the same rate as their peers, and they want to know straight away whether there is something that's underlying that's causing that difficulty and whether they can receive some resourcing to support that child. What I think schools perhaps find more complex is if the child doesn't meet the criteria for their funding, it's difficult for schools to often know how to best support that child's needs.
Yes, now I want to get onto that funding issue in a moment. But Linda, let me ask you this first. You know, as school is underway again for the years, teachers have been meeting their new classrooms, their new classes, their new children, each, with a range of children and their own learning needs. Is it reasonable for us to expect that teachers can cater to everyone in that class?
Yeah, I think it is actually quite reasonable, although I do think that their job is getting harder and harder, and I think that is because of the other expectations that are being placed on them, which is, kind of crowding out their ability to, I guess, zero in on the factors that we're talking about today. But I do believe that when, for example, you see a teacher who is very organised and who knows the children in their class well, and, you can see that it works and it's like a well-run machine. You can have some teachers who are doing it brilliantly, and then there's others who potentially need more support.
Well, we've heard from one parent, Ruth, who lives in a regional area. Her son was diagnosed with ADHD when he was 12. At primary school, she had some success getting him support, but she says that she also found that in many ways the school couldn't meet her son's needs.
It's been quite challenging and a really slow process in getting supports in place. So basically, if I was to leave John unsupported in a typical classroom environment with the expectation that he would be able to do the work that the other students could do, it wouldn't work out well for him at all. And my journey has been, particularly in the last 12 months, has been really strongly advocating to get those supports for John in the classroom within the capacity of the school, which is limiting. To be able to support my son at home with his learning, I didn't have the information that I needed. I wasn't getting that communication. He wasn't getting that feedback. I mean, I even broke it down to a simple, can you just let me know if he has a particularly good day or a particularly bad day? That was the simplest. And my last request, I did eventually give up, but there has been some supports that have been able to be put in place. Unfortunately, not the support of the support teacher to give my son the one-on-one that he needs to be able to do his work. There's several things that might be able to help him, things like breaking the work into smaller tasks and things like that. But these require time and commitment from the class teacher, which with limited resource, I think that has been a bit of an ongoing issue in getting the support that he has needed.
That's Ruth, whose son has ADHD. And this is Life Matters with Amanda Smith, talking about the up and downsides of schools accommodating children with all sorts of learning and intellectual disabilities, physical disabilities as well. So different to 50 years ago when it was separate special schools that catered to many of those children. I'm with Shirley Pode and Linda Graham, whose area is special needs education, and love to hear your experiences with schools nowadays or going back to the days of special schools on Facebook or the SMS 0418 226 576. Shirley, you heard Ruth's story there. In many ways, it sounds like her son hasn't really been able to get the help he needs. Is that a familiar story, particularly outside of metropolitan areas?
Sadly, I'd suggest that it might be. my research looks at families like Ruth where, unfortunately, the school system hasn't been a successful experience for the child with the disability. And I've mainly examined court cases that have involved families like Ruth. So I think that there is certainly a larger proportion of children who are in regional or rural areas who struggle to get the supports that they need, often because, particularly in secondary, there's generally one school, it's quite a large school, and there's a very broad range of learners in that classroom for that teacher to accommodate.
And Linda, are some disabilities and disorders harder to accommodate than others and catered for less well than others?
Yeah, I think, first of all, that story is really representative of what I've heard, and I get contacted by families quite a lot, you know, usually when they're at the absolute end of their tether. I think it's particularly prevalent for kids with a diagnosis of ADHD or who have language disorder. And partly that's because those kids tend to drop off the radar. And that is occurring because they don't have a diagnosis that will enable them to have additional targeted funded support. So when the mum is asking for one-to-one support, that's simply not going to happen. You know, for a child to receive one-to-one targeted support, they would need to have, you know, moderate intellectual disability, severe autism, for example. So a child with a lower, I guess, a diagnosis that doesn't fit into that category of severity, it's not realistic to even consider it.
Consider that they're going to get one-on-one support.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. Shirley, how?
The other point I would make, though, is that one-to-one support, isn't necessarily the right thing to do in that sort of circumstance. And it can be very disabling. You know, there is a lot of research out there that talks about learned dependency, for example, about stigma. That is really not the direction that anyone should be aiming to go. And really, the focus should be on building that child's self-regulation, that child's ability to, I guess, take direction from the teacher. So having one-to-one support isn't going to teach them what they really need to be successful in the long term.
Shirley, do you agree with that?
I do. I think that the set of skills that Linda outlined are the things that that student needs to learn. But I also listened to Ruth talk about the sorts of adjustments that she had hoped for, and they sounded quite reasonable. So things like taking a task and breaking it down into its smaller component parts so that her son could be successful in completing the task. And those things I think are reasonable to do and are standard practice for classroom teachers.
Well, let's hear from Ruth again. She also talks about the importance of something called an individual education plan. Let's hear her on that.
I've worked with some other people in the department to try and get an individual education plan and a reactive strategies plan. It's just very important when you're doing those plans that they have a few qualities. They need to be achievable, they need to be accountable, and they need to have measured outcomes, and that's ongoing work. It's just really hard. I really found that it really needed to be on my toes to try and make sure that things were followed up. Meetings from the minutes, you have to see the outcomes have actually been done. So it can be quite taxing.
Shirley Pode, how does that individual education plan that Ruth talks about there work? Is the school required to follow these plans?
That's a great question. So in Australia, individual education plans aren't mandated under any sort of legislation. What we have is a set of legislation that says schools are required to make a reasonable adjustment for children with a disability, and ADHD is a disability. In most states across Australia, individual education plans, which are known by a range of names, are generally required for children who receive funding. And they're required for two reasons. First of all, it enforces a process whereby the school makes a plan to meet that child's needs, but also it becomes a legal accountability document that says an adjustment has been made. For Ruth's son, it's my guess, like Professor Graham said, that it's unlikely that he was eligible for funding. So that's a grey area in schools as to whether there's a mandate to require a documented plan for children who aren't funded. Our federal legislation says a reasonable adjustment must be provided, and a plan allows that adjustment to be recorded. But there's no mandate on schools to do that for children like Ruth's son, unfortunately.
And Linda, can schools exercise any discretion on who they take, depending on the capacity of that school to accommodate a variety of special needs? Can they reject children on the basis of having needs they can't meet?
That's a good question. Can or do? The DDA or the Disability Discrimination Act would say no. But the reality is that it occurs all the time. So what tends to happen is that there will be, it's not said in a very explicit way in which schools could potentially get in trouble for it, and it's never put in writing. But parents are basically advised that their child will not be well supported within that school because of a lack of resources or whatever, and encouraged to take their child to another school. And that is generally very, very effective, because what parent wants their child in a school where they're not either not wanted or whether their child is not going to be happy and supported? So
What happens though if there isn't another school you can send your kid to, Linda?
Well, the interesting thing is that, we were talking about regional previously, but We, back in 2011 to 2014, I was doing research in New South Wales, and we were looking at the distribution of students with disability and special school support classes. And out in regional areas, of course, there are far fewer of those options available. So schools have no choice but to be inclusive. So that doesn't necessarily mean that the child is getting a better level of support than they would in a city school. But what it means is that there is much less, I guess, leeway for schools to say, we can't do this.
So Shirley, then what's your view on how successful the shift to be inclusive has been, you know, for schools to accommodate a whole spectrum of children with a wide range of learning, physical, other disabilities and disorders, rather than those kids being hived off to special schools? Who has it advantaged and who's it disadvantaged?
It's a complex question, and I'd probably just want to put a caveat that says that it assumes that schools are successful in the way that they're currently structured for children without disabilities. And where you offer an education system where the only commonality that kids have is their age, I would suggest that we need an education revolution, and that what we have is an unsuccessful schooling system for a broad range of children, not just children with disabilities. However, there are lots of children who have come into mainstream schools that have benefited socially, they have strong relationships with their peers when they leave schools, they are part of their local community and are an accepted member of their local community, and there are lots of families that will tell you those success stories. There are also families that have been completely damaged by the process of coming into a mainstream school, where simply breathing the same air hasn't resulted in that child feeling any more included, and in fact they've been more socially isolated than what they were in a special school, where at least there were attempts made to accommodate their learning needs.
Mm. Well, the school year is just underway now, and that can be a tricky time. Let's hear from Ruth again with her concerns, because her son is starting high school this year.
Well, it's new territory for us both. My son's excited because he's happy to be out of the primary school where things weren't working out well for him. So he likes the idea of there being a bit more freedom and being given a bit more responsibilities. As his mum, I have got concerns, and I've done my best to get as many supports in place as possible. We've done things like he's had an early transition plan to high school. So we've had several visits there during the year last year. I've had meetings with the high school staff, and we've worked on the IEP, the learning plan, with the high school staff as well, in a way that's hopefully going to set my son up to succeed. But the twist in all this is that he is actually behind in his work, because nothing did work for him in a significant way in primary school. So he's starting high school quite a way behind in his work. So just really hoping that some of these supports that are in place at the high school, that perhaps they have a better capacity, more resources than the primary school did. Because I do think that he fell through the cracks in primary school. Despite my efforts, it just wasn't enough to support my son.
Well, Linda, if you're a parent and your child is starting primary school this year and you think they might struggle, what can you do?
Well, I mean, my advice is to do pretty much what Ruth has done, which is to be in contact from day one or before that with the school with, I guess, the learning support team, the principal and the deputies, to start there, because, you know, at that point you don't really know who the classroom teacher is going to be. But to make sure that you establish those communication channels early.
Is it best to try to get a diagnosis early? Does giving it a name, whatever it is, mean you can access help more readily?
Yes, look, I think that's a double-edged sword sometimes. And ADHD, I think, in particular, can be a problematic diagnosis, because there is so much stigma and belief, I guess, attached to it. And so sometimes it can work to reduce people's expectations. When I was listening to Ruth, for example, you know, I felt very sorry for her. But the other thing is that her son may have an awful lot of strengths. And, you know, kids who end up with a diagnosis of ADHD have a lot of strengths as well. And that's, I think, really important for parents and for teachers to recognise. Mm. You know, these kids can be very energetic, which in a classroom is not great necessarily, but they can be very energetic in their ideas. They can be very creative. They can be very funny. So I think there are not always should we be looking for deficit.
And that, I think, is a nice way to finish. Linda Graham is Associate Professor in the School of Early Childhood and Inclusive Education at Queensland University of Technology. And Shirley Poad is from the Melbourne Graduate School of Education. Shirley, thank you for joining us.
Appreciate you.
And Linda, thanks to you too.
Thank you, Amanda. Nice to be with you.
Amanda Smith with you on RN. You're listening to Life Matters.